Welcome to the election material design breakout group and workshop. My name is Chris Nance. I serve now as the director of the Cleveland Regional Office. I'm delighted to be here. I am not an expert on election material and design, but I can keep a meeting flowing. So what I'd like to do briefly is to introduce our panel and then move into our discussion. As we move into the discussion, we will have each of the panel members do a brief overview on the subject, and then we'll move through our agenda. Everyone should have an election material design agenda. If you don't, Ed Monroe will make sure that you receive one. I'll just move from left to right. We met Larry Norden, Senior Counsel, Brennan Center, earlier in our opening session. We then have Joanne Fryer, Director of the Ottawa County Board of Elections. Our friend from right here in Franklin County, Matt Damschroeder, the Deputy Director for the Franklin County Board of Elections. And visiting with us today from the University of Missouri, St. Louis, David Kimball, Associate Professor of Political Science. Please join me in a round of applause welcoming our panel. And then I'll start from the far right, and no political pun intended, and then move to the near left, which the pun is intended. Go right ahead, David.
Thank you, Chris. I'll just, to give you a little background, sort of, I guess, where I come from on this. I teach political science at the University of Missouri, St. Louis. I've been there about 8 years and got my PhD here at OSU, so I have a little bit of a local connection. But most of my teaching and research involve voting, elections, election administration. And I also worked on the Better Ballots report that Larry and the Brennan Center produced last year, and participated in some sessions with Larry and some others in Ohio and some other states before the fall 2008 election on ballot design and other usability testing issues. And I guess I just make a couple sort of general points.
David, if you could speak up just a bit.
Yeah, sure. One is that a lot of these design issues involving the design of the absentee ballot envelopes or provisional ballot materials or whatnot sound mundane, but they actually have an effect. It can have an effect on voters making mistakes or poll workers being confused. The other thing that we found is the usability testing that we were involved in, I think, made a difference and identified troublesome things before the election and ways to correct them. And generally, I think, particularly after some of the discussions at the earlier panels this morning, I think most of the things we're talking about here are inexpensive fix. You know, making the provisional ballot envelopes easier to follow is a pretty low-cost solution that doesn't require a lot of money, which so these things may be doable. Thanks.
Thank you, David. Matt?
Thanks, Chris. Piggybacking with what David said, design in elections is very important because what we as elections officials do in terms of laying out ballots, laying out materials, can have a very real and direct impact on whether or not the voter is able to understand the materials and able to properly cast their ballot so that their intent can be read by the Board of Elections and their vote counted. I would point folks to two what I feel are really exceptional resources. The first that David mentioned is the Brennan Center's Better Ballots report that they issued last year, and hopefully Larry will talk some more about that, because I think one of the things that report really does exceptionally well is to take examples of ballot design from across the country where often elections officials, very good intentions, either to save money or to do something in an efficient way, created very significant problems for voters in order to mark their ballot and have their voice counted. The other resource I think is very useful for folks to look at is the Design for Democracy report issued by the United States Election Assistance Commission, where they do a very good job of giving elections officials very simple tools and kind of a, I think they even have a 10-point executive summary of here are 10 things to look at and to do. For those of us in elections, we come from lots of different backgrounds. Very few of us are graphic designers or usability experts. And so having that information as a tool and a resource kind of gives us Design 101 to help to make design all of our materials, whether it be ballots, applications, things of that nature, usable and effective for voters.
Thank you, Matt. Joanne?
I agree with Matt, and I agree with David. And
move it a little closer to the microphone.
And we all have a problem with making the voter realize what he actually needs to do in order to have his ballot count. I was glad when this started out as ballot design, but was broadened to election materials design. Some of the things that we have a lot of trouble with is the absentees. We have to stuff that ballot that goes out, the mail-out ballot, stuff the envelope with voting instructions, the ballot itself, the ID envelope, the return envelope, and because we want to get them back, we usually put a little slip in that says it will cost so much to mail this back to the Board of Elections. We usually put in a hot pink slip of paper that says this issue has been withdrawn because we hadn't changed deadlines yet, or this candidate has withdrawn. We must tell them all this. We just have too much material in this absentee ballot envelope that goes out to them, and it's very confusing for them. The other thing, of course, is the provisional ballots. They are just too confusing. That envelope, that yellow envelope, is too confusing. Some of the things that the election worker has to fill out, we don't need anyway, so why not get rid of it? I think that completely needs to be redesigned. As far as the ballots, perhaps we can limit the ballot language. Our voters are too confused when they see a column, whole column of writing that's in a state issue or a column and a half. Let's cut down the ballot language. And finally, on election day, we have to send out to those polls how many signs? We have to tell them it's against the law to try to vote twice. We have to give them Judge Carr's order that if they don't vote in the correct precinct, their ballot, even a provisional ballot, will not count. We have to tell them their voting rights. We have to tell them where they can call to complain. There are so many things that are pasted on the walls. Most precincts don't have enough wall space anymore. So all of these things are things that I think we can handle at very little cost.
Thank you, Joanne. Larry?
Thanks. So I actually probably got most interested in this topic because of David Kimball and the work that he did on ballots and residual vote rates, which are over and under votes, and where those seem to occur in an unusually high number for things like presidential contests. And And David pointed out that very often we had situations like that where there was some kind of ballot design issue that confused voters and led them to make mistakes. But I want to echo what Joanne said. I do think this is not just an issue with ballots themselves. It's an issue with ID envelopes for absentee ballots. It's an issue for provisional ballots, and it's an issue for all election materials. Matt mentioned the Better Ballots report. It's something that I encourage folks to look at for. We have a checklist in there, the kind of main things, and I think it applies not just to ballots but to all materials for basic principles for good design. As he mentioned, Design for Democracy has a document as well. They also have a kind of a top 10 list of things to look at. I think those things are useful
to look at. And I would say, you know, there's always this tension. Jane Platton this morning talked about voter education, educating voters to fill things out properly. Part of that goes into design. And, of course, voters have a responsibility to make sure that they're following. Sorry, can you not hear me? Oh, okay. I'll try to speak louder. I apologize. Of course, voters have a responsibility to try to follow instructions closely and to fill out forms correctly. But, you know, Matt, I actually had a conversation with Matt Damschroeder about this. This was months and months ago when I was preparing the Better Ballots report, and he made a good analogy, which is, you know, if you had a situation with street signs that confused voters and led to car accidents, you might say it's the voter's fault for getting into the car accident, but you would fix the street signs to make it easier for them to follow. And I think the same principle applies with ballots. In the end, we can say, you know, a voter should have been able to figure this out. But the fact, if there are large numbers that are getting confused and making mistakes, we can do more in education, but we should also look into how we can design things better so there are less mistakes. And that's not just for the benefit of the voter, frankly. It's for the benefit of our elections and for election officials. When voters make mistakes, that creates problems, not just in administration afterwards, but if we have contentious litigations later on because of disputes over what ballots should count and what should not, often it's because it's hard to figure out what the voter was trying to do. So the last thing I would say is I do think that, you know, it's important to follow the kinds of principles that we outlined in our Better Ballots report and that Design for Democracy has detailed, but those things can only take you so far. And one of the things I hope we talk about, it looks like we will a little bit today, is usability testing. That's something that we have done at the Brennan Center with some usability experts and some election officials, and we've really gotten great results from that to kind of figure out the things that election officials should be focused on that might do the most to make the biggest difference for voters and to reduce errors, again, whether it's ballots, applications, registration forms, whatever.
Okay. Thank you, Larry. Just before we begin to work our way through the agenda, I would welcome anyone who wanted to approach the microphone. Our panel, because they are a good panel, has actually touched on every one of the items that are on our agenda, including the redesign and recrafting of election materials, usability testing, and provisional balloting. So just before we kind of work our way through the agenda, again, I'd welcome anyone to approach the microphone. Just please identify, share your name and the county that you are from, and we'll intersperse those questions and answers as we continue to work our way through the agenda. First, I'll defer back to the panel. Were there any other thoughts or comments that anyone wanted to make before we kind of work our way through the agenda? David? Okay. Very good. Okay. We'll take our first question, and then we'll continue to work our way through
the agenda. I have a quickie. I'm Pam Smith. I'm actually from San Diego County, which most of you probably won't recognize. But
hi, Pam. Welcome. Two
questions. One, Larry, did you bring a copy of Better Ballots with you? And for the other panelists, I know in California they recently did an overhaul of the voter registration form to make it easier to understand and fill out more readily, and I didn't know if that had been an issue here in Ohio.
Well, I'll quickly answer the first question. I did not, unfortunately, bring a copy of Better Ballots, but we've been trying to get it out as much as possible to election officials and everybody else. So if anybody wants a copy, we will gladly send you one, and we'll gladly send you our checklist, and you can also find them on the web, but we're happy to mail you one.
Are you responsible, Larry, for writing the summary report for this conference?
Am I? Yes.
Yeah. You are? Well, perhaps it could be one of the appendices to the report.
That's true.
Okay. Just a suggestion.
It's now 575 pages. Right.
We don't have enough.
That's right. Yeah, make him earn his money, right? I think Matt had a comment.
Pam, relative to the question about registration, Ohio has not redesigned our registration form in a number of years. I think when we added the ID requirements post-HAVA was the last time there was really a strong redesign from there, but it really wasn't a top-to-bottom kind of change. I think there's... I think one of the things that we struggle with in Ohio relative to forms, and I think this touches on what Joe was talking about, particularly with the absentee ballot identification envelope, is the tug of war between statutory construction of legal statements, where voters are essentially completing a paragraph of filling in specific blanks. You know, I, Matthew M. Dam Schroeder, at this address, am doing X, Y, Z, preprinted, and that becomes very confusing for voters, as opposed to a more simplified approach where we're doing, you know, bullet points, 1, 2, 3, 4, your name, your address, yes, no. I think all of us are much more used to that kind of approach where we're just simply giving the road information that's needed, as opposed to trying to figure out this confusing, very, in some cases, decades-old language that's very, very confusing.
Please step to the microphone.
Well, I have a whole string, and I'm not going to list them all.
Your name, sir, and what part
Don
is
Don Hollister, Greene County Board of Elections. But the biggest that concerns me is that on the printed ballots, optical scan, the high number of people who just don't make it clear what they meant. And it's bizarre. It's close to 0.5%. Where we have to do remakes and interpret or refuse to interpret what was intended.
Can you give an example of what kinds of problems you see?
Someone makes a little dot in one of the ovals and fills in the other oval. Well, it's probably where they filled in more of it. 300 ballots later, the difference between the two fill-ins isn't quite so stark. You have someone who fills in two, crosses out one, circles the other, and initials where they crossed out. Mm-hmm. Well, and then you have teams, since you have high volume they've got to get done, remade, and you discover that one team is interpreting those one way, and the other team is interpreting them another way. And there are more varieties than those, but those are...
Well, one thing I would say, and I think that's very interesting about doing usability testing, and basically all that means is having voters come in, just typical voters come in and work through a ballot and watching them, is that you start to see why people make some of these mistakes. And I'll give you a couple of examples, and it was interesting because I was looking through how people were mismarking the ballots in Minnesota. But very often a reason that people mismark ballots is because they can't see that well. So you'll have a situation where the oval may be a light gray, but they weren't able to see, so they end up Xing next to it. Or it's easier for them to see the timing mark next to the oval, so they end up circling that. Sometimes it's who knows what people are actually doing, but a good number of times there's some explanation that you can see, and if you do that testing beforehand, it's sometimes possible to come up with solutions that make those kinds of errors less frequent. And we did some testing out in a county in California, and not everybody can do this, but they had a problem where their ovals were too light and voters weren't seeing it. So the official decided that she was going to put the ovals in a dark red, like a bolded red, that would make it easier for voters to see. And there are all kinds of examples like that. You're never going to get rid of errors 100%, but I do think that... watching voters and seeing what they're doing can often help in the future with design to reduce those errors.
Before we go on, one of the other things that you do need, is a good policy written by your board and adopted by your board on what constitutes a valid vote.
Oh, back to his point. Yes. Hi, I'm Jane Barnett from Butler County, and this is talking about usability, in essence, and it's talking about how do we change some of the forms without spending any more money. One of the things that we've looked at, like everyone, you know, provisionals are a problem, but we've been able to move our provisional rate from like 17% error rate when we first started down to 5%, and there's a lot of reasons for that.
Well, you're going to share a couple?
Well, yeah, if you want to know. But okay. But the one I'm talking about now, because this is design,
okay,
is we looked at the type of mistakes that were being made on the provisional. And the state has a required provisional. Everything has to be in there. But it does not have to be exactly lined up that way. So you can put, for example, birth date is being missed a lot. We put birth date up higher, mm-hmm. put the lines like people know what birth date's supposed to look like. Mm-hmm. We labeled ID number one, and on the back, we labeled number one, whether you check off, you know, where the poll worker checks off, number one, ID, you know, or driver's license. We labeled number two, labeled, you know, the things, put them in order. Other, then other, and then here were the examples of the others in the back. Bolded areas that had to be signed. Mm-hmm. There are small graphic design elements that you can use that can take the state form. Now I'm talking specifically the provisional. There are other things you're not allowed to touch. You can't change anything. Provisional form says all of these things have to be included, but you don't have to use the exact way that it is. And if you look at your errors and where your errors are occurring, then you redesign and put more emphasis and boldness on those error rate, and then that's one of the ways that you can reduce your error rate. Now, that's not the only one, but the biggest one, if you want to know, is that we instituted quality control, in that every provisional that is done must be examined by a second poll worker and signed off on. And in training, we do scenario training where we give them provisionals like the, let's say, and only one thing is wrong, and they all have to find, and they have like seven or eight of them, they have to find those. And then we start to understand the rhythm. Look here, look here, look here. This, oh, if it's marked here, it's got to be marked here in the back. So we try to teach them that rhythm. Mm-hmm. But the quality control has been a very important part of two people have to look at every provisional. That also means they have to look at the precinct level. If it's not in that precinct and they say their street is somewhere, two people have to look up in the street directory, okay? And also, if somebody doesn't belong in that precinct, we have a card that you have to fill out. You made up a little card. And if you're sending them to another precinct, we make you write, here's the the person writes their name and address. Very hard for people to always hear an address. If they see it written, it's better. So then they look it up, and we have two poll workers sign that, and they must independently look. Mm. And then if they go to the wrong precinct, then they're told, the precinct workers call the board, mm-hmm. because we say there's two out of four people that cannot read a poll listing, and so we immediately send someone to that precinct. And that's, I mean, there are ways to really cut your errors just by quality control, redesign, looking at where the mistakes have been. And I believe that's what you were talking about as far as the usability.
Exactly.
Yeah, actually, I mean, that's a great point. And that is what I'm talking about. Although I would say, you know, one of the things that usability experts say is that everything gets a usability test eventually. The question is when. So, you know, if you have a ballot that has a problem in it, it gets a usability test, but it may be the election when the usability test is, and it'll be too late then. It sounds like you're doing exactly the right thing and looking at what kinds of errors there are. I'd say for, if it's possible, if there's the time, getting voters in beforehand, whenever you do a redesign, and having them go through it and see what their experience is can be very helpful. And I should also add, there are resources for election officials, Design for Democracy, if you send them stuff to look at and say, what do you think of this?
Yeah, I read that.
They'll look at it, and we have folks at the Brennan Center who work with us that are happy to look at materials and provide feedback. And, they're not necessarily average voter, but they have enough experience that they're likely to be able to say that this might be a potential problem for voters, this or that.
Oh, that's the Brennan Center?
How many people knew that that kind of resource was available,
that
you could send information to the Brennan Center, have them look at your...
Or Design for Democracy. I don't want to get them all.
I mean, obviously, not to bypass the Secretary of State's office, but as an additional resource. I also wanted to quickly say that I thank you very much for your suggestions. And as we kind of work our way through the first question, are there other... You suggested basically what I would describe as some changes that we're making can make kind of in between the lines. Are there statutory changes that are kind of sticking people's craw as it relates to election material design that if you could wave a magic wand and change them, that you would make that suggestion to make life easier? Yes.
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 The answer.
Yes, Greene County again. I would put school board at the top and governor or president at the bottom. That's a philosophical statement more than ballot
design.
Well,
with ballot rotation.
It would be huge.
Yeah.
It would be great.
Okay. Matt?
Yes. There are a number of statutory considerations that I think would be advisable to revise. I think part of the challenge is that most of the existing statutes governing ballot design were drafted in the 1950s when everyone had hand-marked printed ballots. I think the requirement at that time was hot letting presses and the whole nine yards. I think that we may have gotten away from that finally. But there are all kinds of considerations there in terms of font sizes, bolds, not bolds, typeface, caps versus no caps, and then rule width, dividing candidates and dividing different contests, and not really none of those design requirements of the statute, particularly when it comes to dividing candidates with certain rules and things like that, rule widths, are either recommended by design and usability experts, but in most cases they're not even able to be accommodated through the technology that we use now.
Yeah.
And so both the Secretary of State's office, when they issue their directive on ballot design, has to kind of be careful of, how do they prescribe a ballot that is consistent with the law, but that boards of elections can come up with using their various voting systems for the design. So I think what happens in the end is a lot of counties kind of freelance their design, and the voting vendors have done a good job of trying to be flexible with their systems, but there's still some constraints there. So I think my personal view is that the whole section, as it's currently prescribed, ought to be thrown out and start over.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Actually, in the Better Ballots report, we listed Ohio as one of three states that we identified as having really problematic requirements for ballots. One of the things that is unusual about Ohio is this separate requirement, separate instruction for the presidential contest. And going back to David's point, I mean, there's something that, it just takes up extra space, particularly for paper ballots. That can often be an extra expense. You may have to go over to another page, depending on how many contests you have. And following up on something Joanne said, if you have these ridiculously long ballot initiatives and you have to print the entire all of the language, that costs money, and it's not plain language for people. And I think in general that should be a principle of it's kind of a design principle, but certainly a principle for materials that we're giving to voters. Too often you have lawyers that are responsible, and I can say this because I'm a lawyer, that are responsible for, you know, writing up the language for ballot instructions, writing up the language for the initiatives that people are going to have to follow, writing up the affirmations that people have to sign to. And I can't say that I know this is the case in Ohio, but certainly in a number of states there are requirements and affirmations. It would be, I've got to believe that 90% of the people don't know what they're signing because there are terms that are used in there that just aren't plain English.
Well, I think an example of, I think an example of that is in litigation that we had last year over provisional ballots is that the attorneys on the two different sides of the issues were using different names for the different affirmations, and the Supreme Court justices pointed out that, you know, if essentially the lawyers on the two sides arguing can't understand which affirmation is which, how is a voter ever going to figure it out?
Yeah. I also want to pick on David, just before you comment, I also want to pick on our friends from ES&S and any other vendors that may be in the room as we continue to the second question in terms of the usability testing. My base of experience on the usability of ballots is connected to our experience in Cuyahoga County, which has obviously experienced a little bit of a transition over the last couple of years. And Jerry, I don't want to put you on the spot, but I would be interested in hearing some feedback from the vendors. In terms of the usability testing, the number of test decks. Now, I don't know if this is apples and oranges. If it is, someone can correct me. But the number of times that we ran the ballots, you know, through the testing process. Is that considered, Jerry, part of the usability testing of ballots as we're making sure that the design and the timing marks and all of that is lined up? And as you come, there's a part two to the question in terms of statutory issues. I want to also ask you to address any potential statutory changes that as a vendor might be considered to make the printing and the production of ballots more readily able to be done.
Okay. I'll start with Cuyahoga. Cuyahoga actually went way beyond what we recommend for testing of test decks. With them implementing a new system up there, Jane Platten, the director, I applaud her for this, really gave it the old stress test. We ran their test deck through her 650s probably 10 times, and the test deck was about 11,000 ballots. So we ran a lot of ballots through their machines, but normally we would run the test deck through the hardware one time. And it does a couple of things. It tests the hardware, but we're really testing the cards to make sure that the logic of the election is correct and that the software will read the cards in correctly and everything should match up. So it's a process.
And the tolerances of the machine?
Well, it's not two tolerances. As you know, the 650 is a high-speed scanner, so the ballots are going through a lot faster than our little optical scanners that we put in the precinct. So there are some tolerances, but they both read at about 99 to the fifth percent accurate. Okay? Now, based on what he was talking about, you know, the little dots and the ovals and stuff, the 650s are usually picked out of the indeterminate mark, and what it's doing, and Cuyahoga had a kind of an issue with this, it was kicking it out, and they were wondering why it would kick it out. Well, it's telling us, hey, the machine can't make the decision. We have to have some human intervention to say, is the little dot a mark or is it not a mark? So that was kind of their deal up there. But and secondly, about the ballot, and he touched on it, you know, when we design the ballot with ovals, the oval can only be so dark. If you get it too dark, then the scanners, either one of them, is going to start picking it up as a mark. So we have to keep it what we call a light gray in order for the hardware not to pick it up as a mark as it's being scanned. So that's kind of that. As far as design, I've got a couple things that I've tried to get my counties to go through the association to come up to your office, Chris, on why we can't get the directives out a little sooner for the ballot layout. And the reason being, how we know who's going to be on the ballot, the president and all the candidates, so we should be able to get that layout to us much sooner, which would allow us to get it out and design sooner, which would give us more time to do a usability test. Because to me, what I'm hearing a usability test is we design a ballot and let voters come in and use it. It has nothing to do with testing it. It's usability of the voter. And am I right there? Okay, thanks. And the other thing is...
It's like a two-part process.
Two-part process, right. And the other thing, back to the directive, is back to presidential, we made quite a few changes to our instructions, the vote for text, and the, like the president, I mean the candidate names being up or lower, based on feedback from the Brennan Center. And don't take this the wrong way, but we get the directive out this year, this for this primary, and it's changed it back to the old way again. So we need to get a consistency. To me, I think we should have about four templates that we use every single election, and we shouldn't even need a directive hardly. So that's kind of my opinion.
Jerry, right. Thank you. David?
I would just, to go back to the question about the election code, I mean, I think that's one of the opportunities here if the legislature is willing to simplify what the election code requires for a number of these materials. I mean, a couple of other things I noticed, some that were mentioned here before, and I think the preliminary report that Larry put together for the conference compared the absentee ballot envelope for Ohio to the one used in Oregon. Oregon's been doing vote by mail now for like 10 years, and so they've pretty carefully thought through all their election materials since everybody's voting by mail. And in Oregon, the envelope is very neat and simple. I can't remember exactly everything on there, but you write your name, you write your date of birth, you sign it. Boom, that's it.
The contrast, I don't mean to interrupt you, but people should look in the appendix, and that they can find that online at the Oregon absentee ballot, because it's the envelope, because it's so, the contrast between that and Ohio is incredible. It's so much simpler. It's amazing.
I think as Matt mentioned, Ohio, obviously it's much more involved, and there's this legalese jargon. By signing this, you attest to blah, 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 blah. And, you know, we looked at why is it like this. Well, the election code pretty seems to state this is what it has to be. And so, obviously, if you want to make things simpler, it's, the law has to change. Another error I noticed was in Ohio, the presidential portion of the ballot is pretty long. Partly it's because there were a lot of candidates that qualified for the ballot in Ohio for president, but part of it is because every presidential candidate has the label president listed underneath the name. Every vice presidential candidate has a label vice president listed under the name, and that's required by state law, which makes it very, very long, and it's not obvious to me why you need the labels. The voters generally are going to know who the presidential or vice presidential candidates are, or there's other ways you can sort of make that clear without putting the word in there every time. So I think things like that are areas where the law could be changed. It's not going to cost anything, but it'll simplify things.
And does the ballot rotation requirements, does that further complicate the design of our election materials?
The election official could say more of that than I could, I think.
Maybe it doesn't.
I think it may complicate things in other ways. I'm not.
Yes. It does complicate it.
You speak in the microphone.
I can't remember now the one scenario that we had where we actually had to leave space to accommodate a rotation. And I wish I could remember it right now. But, yes, it does. It does complicate it. That's right.
Just because the session is recorded, I'll just repeat that. You know, what Jerry said was, you know, if you have a long name as a result of the ballot rotation law, you have to make sure that you have enough space, right, for the longest name in every place in that particular rotation. Okay. All right.
That was it, Jerry. Thanks.
Okay. Please.
This gets a little more abstract, but since you said rotation, rotation plays in differently in different company hardware and in different ballot layouts. And I don't know if what study said it, but I'll remind people that I was always taught whoever's at the top gets 5% more votes, just as an abstract result. So rotation's important, and where we short that because of the mechanics of precinct rotation or rotation in printed ballots or the way a DRE is laid out, we do affect the vote totals, supposedly. And I think it also, and this was a question I skipped earlier, it affects write-ins. How does a write-in, it's amazingly easy on some DREs, but it's, I'm not sure how you would write in on the optical scans that we've been using.
Thank you. We're working our way through the second question. Should Ohio consider testing ballots before use to identify potential design problems? And what are the costs and the benefits of such a proposal? We've talked a little bit about that in terms of it being a two-part process. I'm not sure if the panel has any other thoughts on that before we continue on.
I'll just add, I mean, when I first learned about that there was such a thing as usability testing, I thought, oh, good, this is going to be complicated and you have to have a PhD in whatever usability is to do it. But having gone through this a couple times with people at the Brennan Center, it's really pretty simple. As Larry said, you just find some voters to come in, maybe relatives or buddies from high school or anybody, and have, you know, observe them with a couple staff people while they go through it. It takes, you know, an hour or two. That it's not as involved or as complicated as I initially imagined. And you can discover potential problems before an election when they're going to.
Yeah, I want to. I think the main issue is not cost at all. It's time. It's how much time do you have? Very often, I know election officials are just, they're under the gun. They get some proof back, and they don't really have a lot of time to make changes, and then send them back and get back whatever changes there are from the vendor. But it really only should take a couple of hours. And as David said, it costs nothing other than the couple of hours that you have to have some workers observing the process. And you don't generally, I mean, we did this enough before the last election. You don't generally find huge things, but every time we did it, we found something. And my favorite example of this is what we did in Florida, because the ballots there are pretty standard. They're all using optical scan systems. And they were pretty, the directive from the Secretary of State was pretty clear on what they had to do. And this doesn't sound like a big deal, but it ended up having a big impact. We noticed that a lot of voters, when they came in to vote on the ballots, were not turning them over. And so we only worked in two counties in Florida. And so David will tell you that this is not a scientific result. But the two counties that we did, we said, why don't you just put a... There was turnover all the way at the bottom of the ballot. Why don't you just have a little note that says turnover right under the last contest, immediately under it, so their eye goes to it right away. And those two counties had a much lower undervote rate on everything that was on the state ballot initiative that was on the second page than the other counties. They had a higher percentage of people turning over the ballot, in other words, and voting there. So, you know, we didn't discover the butterfly ballot in doing that, but it did have an impact on getting more people's votes counted.
Just out of curiosity, I worked a polling place, happens to have been my polling place that I first voted in, and I worked that particular location in the 2008 election. And one of the things that I found is that, particularly early in the day when it was really crowded, this is a very basic thing, but when the crowds began to come in the morning, we didn't have signs for the precinct locations, right? And so I literally, you know, I said, well, people don't know what lines to go into. They don't know what table to go to. So we whipped out some magic markers. We got some blank pieces of paper, and we stuck up on the wall, you know, A, B, D, E, and F. And actually, a friend of mine who lived in the neighborhood went home, printed out, you know, A through F on his computer and brought back, you know, computer-generated signs. I'm interested to know what other kinds of ideas you perhaps have had to use in terms of election materials to help to ease speed, make more convenient the voting process. That was something in Cuyahoga County with 580 polling locations, with 1,400 precincts, which will shrink. We're in the process of going through kind of a downsizing of those appropriately within the appropriate guidelines. But are there any other ideas or recommendations that folks have found or think would be helpful in smoothing the voting process in terms of materials?
My name's Mike Johnson. I'm here with the Libertarian Party, but this relates to when I was a poll worker for a primary a few years ago. The area where I worked was a combined precinct, and it was a partisan primary, and the primary ballots, the provisional ballots, were packaged in such a way that when we set up the provisional balloting table, all of the ballots were not laid out. And it was about an hour or two into polling before we realized the difference between the different precincts. So I don't know that people voted on the wrong ballot, but it was certainly a possibility due to the way that the ballots were shipped from the county board. Mm-hmm. So looking at how things are packaged at the warehouse could help alleviate some of the issues, at least with the provisional balloting.
I don't know if Joanne or Matt, do you have anything to add to that in terms of how you help to head that kind of issue off?
Well, we're a small county, so when we pack ballots in the precinct bags or whatever we're sending them out in, if there's a split, we put a sticky note on it, big letters, precinct 3A, Lake Local School District. And we do that on each pad of those. So that's one thing that we do.
And I think that the issue that you raise, I think speaks to one of the things in elections administration generally, and that is that we're in a constant state of improvement. Every election we learn something new. Maybe it's been the same problem that's been happening for a while, but it comes to the surface at one particular election. So we're constantly changing and improving and enhancing how we do things. And I recognize Karen Cotton from our office, who's our elections administrator, election operations manager in our office. And I think she's been very instrumental helping us over her very long career at the board of every different election, looking at what worked and what didn't. Do we need to package something differently? Do we need to put these materials together because they go together, or different labels and those kind of things? So I think one of the other examples I was using would be is Keith Cunningham in Allen County, who has a grade card for his poll workers. So based on the way they return materials, they get a score based on returning it properly, and that creates for him an objective method not only to measure poll workers but also to measure his office's effectiveness at giving instructions and putting things together, so that they can identify if all the poll workers in a group are having a problem with this particular aspect of the grade card, then that's an area that his office needs to examine.
I believe I'm correct about this. I thought it was an interesting idea. It's in the report, but I can't remember. I can't remember exactly what they did, but my memory is that Cuyahoga County, on their registration forms, highlighted the request for the phone number.
Right.
That they put it in some kind. They highlighted it in some way. Maybe it was with a yellow color or something like that.
Yeah, key information.
Again, I mean that's kind of a usability thing. It reminded people to provide their phone numbers, but if there were mistakes on there. Registration form, the county could contact them to correct it. So I do think like little things like that can make a big difference in making sure that people are able to vote.
We're moving to the end of the session. It's we have a little more time, but if we end up adjourning early, I don't think anybody is going to be mad at the panel or mad at me. But provisional balloting materials, The last gentleman raised a question about how the materials were actually delivered. Obviously, we've talked about some of the mistakes that people make on provisional ballot materials and absentee ballot envelopes. I was chatting with a couple of folks at the end of the previous session, and the absentee ballot rejection rate, and excuse me for continuing to use Cuyahoga County as an example, but it's the county I know best, was a little bit higher because people just make mistakes. You know, they send the ballot back outside of the voter ID envelope. They don't sign it. And obviously these are the kinds of things that, again, because of Ohio law and statute, if a voter fails to execute those things, we can't count the ballot. So I'm not sure if anyone has any thoughts or recommendations on ways that they help to close the gap on that, including adding instructions, information in the ID envelopes, emphasis in training. Any other thoughts on absentee ballot and making it a little bit smoother, make people fill out the information accurately?
I want to follow up on something that Joanne said, which is, it was implied anyway, with all of the instructions that you have when you get to the polling place, there's so many, there's such a thing as vote information overload. And I think I understand that there are reasons for requiring certain information from voters when they're filling out absentee ballots or provisional ballots, but I really do think the goal should be to keep them to a minimum, because the more you ask of voters, it's just human nature, the more likely that somebody's going to miss something or skip something or make a mistake. So again, I realize that probably means legislative changes in Ohio, but it seems to me that's a worthy goal.
David?
I guess the one thing I would add, this is more for provisional ballots, but I think with provisional ballots there's sort of an extra layer of complexity, because there's a part that the voter does, there's also a part that the presiding judge or poll worker fills out, and so there's sort of a double opportunity for something to go wrong if there's going to be confusion or mistake. But that same sort of principle of designing things simpler, easier to follow, would apply there as well.
So I'll ask if there are any other final questions, or Joanne or Matt, if you have any final thoughts or comments as we wrap up the session. Another couple questions? Go right ahead.
Real quick. Jake Schlachter, Miami County. A lot of what we've come up with so far today seems to come down to legislative changes that need to be made. I'm curious which groups are advocating for these common sense or straightforward changes, or are they just percolating in the legislature?
Well, I would say that from one of the first levels of folks that are advocating for changes is our Ohio Association of Elections Officials. I think part of the challenge sometimes with the General Assembly is that a lot of these kind of changes that we're talking about are not really big, exciting political issues like voter ID or no-fault absentee or some of those kinds of things, but they're the kind of common sense things that you and I and Joe and Marilyn have to deal with every election that would make it easier for us to do our job to better serve the public. And so I think sometimes the challenge is to get the attention of the legislature and to say, you know, while you're doing these other fun and exciting things, you need to also address these issues. And our association has been very diligent on that, and I know that that's part of the continuing legislative agenda of the association.
Mm-hmm. And Larry and Joanne David, just as we follow up on Matt's point, I would think that one of the advantages of using the platform, you know, of this conference is to have recommendations come through the conference as well. Clearly, the Association of Election Officials is a key kind of point through which recommendations can be made. But I also think that that is one of the opportunities that we have in convening the conference consider an even broader set of recommendations. And I think we heard also from one of our legislative representatives that he is open. The opportunity, I think, to share ideas is certainly I think, perhaps a little more opportune, and I think we should take advantage of it.
And Chris, if I could just add quickly, I'm sorry, that along with that, you know, as I look around the room, there's a lot of elections officials, but there's also a lot of folks from the academic side of things and also some folks from the advocacy community. I think there's a significant role that you all can play as well in a part of that, because the more different sides of the equation that we can show to the General Assembly, so it's not just the elections officials saying this is what we need, but then the academics can come in and say here's what the peer-reviewed research shows, and some of the advocates can come in and say here's the effect of some of these things from the voters that we work with. So it kind of has a little bit of a groundswell aspect of things. Again, it's not nearly as exciting as voting machines and provisionals and ID, but it's really kind of one of those foundational issues that if we don't address, the best technology in the world isn't going to be able to help solve the problem.
Deidre Reese from the League of Women Voters, and just in response to the last question, the League, along with Ohio Citizen Action, Common Cause, the Advancement Project, certainly the Brennan Center, we're trying to gather together academics as well as advocacy groups so that we can put forward some common sense reforms that, you know, hit at every level, and really those things that we think there is a lot of commonality and agreement. We want to go ahead and move that forward as we continue to work on the more difficult things. We believe that there are some things that can be done right now that probably have minimal or no cost that is going to, you know, cause our election system to function more efficiently and certainly enfranchise more voters, because that's what we really are all about. And there was a comment that was made earlier about provisional ballots, and, you know, we do have sort of a differentiation. Some people feel that we need all these different, you know, bells and whistles and hoops to go through to prove that the person is an elector. There are others that certainly believe that these are really barriers that are causing it to be much more difficult. And, you know, at least the League believes that we should presume that people are qualified voters and give them that opportunity rather than disqualify their ballot because of some technical error or poll worker or just human error. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Will there be a way for people to somehow offer their thoughts or input as a part of that process that you just describe with those organizations?
Absolutely. I will give you my email address. Please let me know if you are interested. We will just, you know, ship out to you. We've been meeting by conference call mostly, but we are trying to gather together, do some face-to-face work. You can write that down. It's legleg@lwvohio.org.
Mm-hmm. And do you have a projected kind of goal in terms of the gathering of input and then producing and moving it to some next step?
We hope that we can get a lot of the legwork done here in the spring. We certainly know the legislature is going to be focused on the budget primarily, but we believe that we can get some things passed certainly in this session, but we hope before the end of this calendar year.
Okay. Terrific. So I've heard three things. There's input and feedback to the folks organizing this conference, which is obviously the Secretary of State's office. I've heard the Ohio Association of Election Officials. And then to Matt's point, and thank you, Deidre, for sharing, the League and Coalition with other organizations are also moving a process forward. So there's lots of ways to, I think, plug in and make sure that if you have a thought or an opinion that you want to share, a recommendation, there's lots of ways, I think, to provide that input. Ron?
Ron Olson from Cuyahoga County, an activist. On Matt's point and also Deirdre's point, when the
you
election
speak up just a little bit, Ron, I'm sorry.
Sure. When the Election Official Association is doing this work to put together your recommendations, do you do that by involve other groups and say, here are our recommendations, what do you think? And so maybe some of that negotiation or discussion can happen before it gets to the legislators?
Well, I think speaking for myself for a moment, I think one of the things that I'm hopeful that will come out of this conference, similar to the report that Larry's offered on the previous conference, is kind of a set of, if not specific action items, areas that we can all agree are things that need to be worked on, and then that we can go from there. Historically, the way our association has worked is that we identify topics that are of concern for us, identified by our legislative committee, and then we identify members of the General Assembly to attempt to have someone introduce either legislation or amendments along the way. And at that point, that's where it becomes more of a public dialogue. But we're certainly more than happy to work with other organizations on specific issues, and I'm hopeful that some of Larry's reports can be the impetus for some of those conversations.
Please step forward.
Two things that we try to keep in mind. The first is, we as Board of Elections, when we're sending anything out to poll workers, if we're sending it out to voters, you need to remember we're competing with the largest, most expensive advertisers that there are in the United States. Okay? I mean, somebody opens their mail and they're getting Capital One, and they're getting General Motors, and they're getting Pepsi, and then they're getting this thing from us that looks like it's not, we don't want to spend the money for color, you know, we've got, you know, all this stuff all spaced together so that it's one page. So you need to realize your audience is not just waiting to hear this stuff that we're sending them. And so that when we talk about design, I mean, that's why the graphic design of the materials you send out is critical. And the second thing is the readability statistics. All of you, if you have, you know, you have Word, you can set it so you can look at the readability statistics of what you're sending out. A regular newspaper, the readability is at fifth grade. The New York Times, I'm sorry, the Wall Street Journal is at seventh grade. If you look at how, if you run through Word and set your readability statistics at documents that you are sending out, that you're writing, these aren't just necessarily prescribed by the state, but you're writing directions on how to do it, you're probably sending them out at an 11th or 12th grade readability. So we need to step back as boards of elections and look at the 20% of the people in Ohio are functionally illiterate to start out with. Okay? There's one group. And many of those people are registered. They didn't all not register. Then you have this large group that their readability is really going to be, you know, the newspaper level. And if we opt when we're sending letters to them, to because we're used to sounding so important, and we opt to write it at the 11th grade level, of course they don't understand. And we sit there saying, well, we sent it out to them. What's wrong with it? Why don't they get it? So I think if we start to think of them, of course they're voters, but think of them as consumers, and that we're competing against, number one, all the other things that they get, and all those companies already know in design about reading levels, et cetera. And number two, if we really step back and say, how clear are we, and how many people have worked on this letter, and by the time everybody has put their 25 cents in and the sentence has gotten this long, well, you don't even know where the verb is, okay, let alone the action that, you know, that's required. So those are kind of two summary statements, but I think you'll really find, if you go back to your stuff and do your readability, that it's really high. And those are things that we're opting to send. The ones from the state or an issue, we don't have any control over that. But we do have control over those things.
Thank you. It also quickly prompted two things, that in terms of people involved in reviewing your ballots, people who are business people, marketing experts, might be another interesting set of eyes to review some of your materials, some of the ways that we communicate with our voters, and then the resource of our community colleges in particular. I know in Cuyahoga County, the community colleges serve as a physical location for poll worker training, and also they've offered to be a resource for a number of other kinds of educational opportunities for the voting process, clearly a critical part of what we try to accomplish. Is there any how about the final question?
I wanted to hear again, what were the two things that Matt Damschroeder recommended? One was better ballots from the Brennan Center and design for democracy from
the Election Assistance Commission. And if you and the better ballots, I think, Larry, is on the Brennan Center website.
Yeah, it is. So if you go to the Brennan Center website, there's a little search function. If you just put in better ballots, you'll get it.
And then if you go to eac.gov, that's the website for the Election Assistance Commission, and they have on their website the Design for Democracy. There's and I think there's also actually a Design for Democracy website that you can link through to that is offered by the American Association of, I can't remember who the graphic designers. Graphic designers that has downloadable icons and formatting tips. It's a big resource, but it's worth taking an afternoon in the summer and really pouring through to, like I said, take Design 101 for election officials.
And the other thing is, if you don't feel like printing it out, I think you can also just write to the EAC and they'll send you a free copy as well.
Yep.
Right. And also for those who have need for things in foreign languages in terms of instructions, I know the EAC has a variety of materials available, certainly in Spanish. I'm not quite sure the variety of other languages that are available in terms of materials and publications, but in a couple of visits to the EAC, I have seen those materials, and we have some of those materials as we have various parts of the state. There are 87 languages spoken in Cuyahoga County alone. And so language issues certainly, literacy issues and language issues certainly are becoming more and more of a part of what we have to consider in the voting process. Any final comments by our panelists?
I just add response to the question from the man from Miami County about advocacy. Since I've suggested legislative changes here, I'd be glad to add my voice to that effort and work with the Election Officials Association or other groups that want to persuade the legislature to make those changes.
Terrific. Please join me in thanking our panelists. Matt, Joanne, David, and Larry, we appreciate your attendance this afternoon. We are adjourned. Thank you.